This is Solace.
And this is Rags.
And welcome to Samosa Caucus. It's our first episode. We're excited to be with you.
This is going
to
be a fun podcast. What are we focusing on here, Solace? Let's tell the folks.
Okay, so the idea of Samosa Caucus is there's increasing number of South Asians in politics and policy in the U.S., in the West. So we're all over the place. We haven't really, like, pushed a common message or a common theme. So we're kind of going to be exploring some different aspects of being South Asian in the West. And because there are so many organizations that have the name South Asian at the front of them, we didn't want to do that. So we decided to adopt the name Samosa Caucus.
Yeah, it seems to be a fairly common theme. Like, I think there was an article that came out a little while ago as well, that was talking about the Samosa Caucus. And, you know, I think it's an interesting time right now. It's not that we're just going to focus on South Asians, like you said, right out in the U.S., just around the world. And, you know, we're just going to give you our take on, you know, what general policies have been and how South Asians are starting to get in and work with the political system and, you know, influence and be big influencers around the world. So I think it's exciting times. Just real quick about ourselves. I'm a developer, but I'm also really super politically inclined. Solace and I have known each other a while, and we were talking about putting a podcast together, and, you know, the Samosa Caucus thing came up, and, you know, I think this would be a good theme, a fun theme to work with.
I'm also a developer, so we're both developers. We're both South Asian developers. It's a stereotype, I know, but we're also...
Nice, yes. Living the stereotype. That's how we like to roll.
Yeah, and our first theme is H-1B, so I think when we get around to that topic, we can dive more into that, but that kind of fits with the whole software developer stereotype.
Just to go over real quick, like you know, we call ourselves developers, but both of us have been, like, kind of been all over the place with stuff that we've done otherwise. And we'll go into some of that, you know, as we put out other episodes and, you know, go into some of our other background as well. I'm sure it'll come up because I don't know about you, but I'm definitely a little bit of a narcissist. So I'll try and bring myself up if and when I can. let's hop into the first thing that we want to talk about, which was everything around the H-1B stuff that's kind of happening right now.
So I don't know about a lot of people who are second generation in America who are South Asian came where our parents were H-1B originally. So H-1B, what is it? It means that you come over, you're tied to an employer, you have a visa for as long as you're with that employer. And it's a high-skilled type of visa. So the idea is that employer looked for somebody for that position in America, couldn't find anyone, and then searched internationally, found someone, and is bringing that person over to America to work. So as long as they have that job, they have the H-1B visa, they're sponsored by that employer. But if they don't have that job anymore, then they don't have the visa anymore. It's tied. So that was big in the 1970s. Currently, 70% of H-1B visa holders are Indian nationals. I think it's 70% of visa holders, or it might be 70% of people who came last year. I should take better notes, but it's basically a large percentage of the people who are here on H-1B are Indian nationals.
I think that's a fair representation of what H-1Bs are. And the 70% number, I think we'd have to go back and look at that because I know for a fact that it's probably closer to 80 or 90% of applicants. I don't know. It's possible that the sum total of H-1B holders fall into that category, but safely say that the number of applicants themselves are just massive. So to give you some idea, I think last year there were, do you have numbers on the total number of H-1B visas allowed? I think it's something like 170,000 a year or something like that.
No. I think, there was a peak of 195,000 per year in the early 2000s, but even last year it was down to 65,000, and then plus 20,000 for people with masters who got their masters in the U.S. So it's actually come down a lot over time since the peak in the early 2000s.
But the number of applications are still fairly high from what I understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure the number of applications is significantly higher than
that. Yeah. And also to point out to people who aren't really aware of what the visa actually is, it's more like a lottery system now because there are so many applications. I really thought that I saw somewhere like there were like 200,000 applications or something. And so essentially what it is, it becomes a lottery. So it literally is like, okay, well, here's, you know, Apple, you filed for X number, you know, Google's filed for X number, other software companies have filed for X number, you know, the big Indian consulting firms have done for whatever. And then it's like truly a lottery, at least from what we know, where they just go and pick out a set of folks and they're like, okay, there you go.
Yeah, I saw that 200,000 number too. I think it's the 200,000 is applicants, and that's applicants in the first several days of it opening, and then it becomes the lottery. Because the idea is you really need those people, but it's higher than the cap. It's way higher than the cap. So it becomes a lottery system.
Yeah, so the interesting part also with the large number of, you know, people of South Asian descent taking over, especially from the Indian subcontinent, a large number of these are also applied for by, you know, these a chunk of them are boutique consulting companies locally in the Bay, but then they're also by some of the bigger consulting firms, Infosys, Tata, Cognizant. And so they actually file a fair few of H-1B visas. So the way that would manifest itself is, you know, an Apple or Google or someone would be like, hey, you know, we need a bunch of developers to do this one thing, writing in something in this language of this level. And we are willing to pay some amount of money for that. Let's say, you know, $50, $60, $70 an hour. And then a consulting company like a Tata or Infosys or any other smaller consulting company would be like, hey, I can offer you a candidate who's really well qualified for, you know, for that amount. And then what they do is they go and source those candidates or find them overseas or wherever it is, or part of their corporate structure is basically to hire and train a bunch of people. So they'll find people overseas and then they'll come in and say, they'll go to the guys, the individual candidates, and say, okay, well, you can work for this company and go to the U.S. on this H-1B visa, and we can pay you maybe $40 an hour, right? And so what they do is they run payroll for those guys, pay some taxes, and then they basically pocket the rest. The consulting companies, if you could think of them, they're basically middlemen. The H-1B visa also comes with its own intricacies. For example, once you're on an H-1B visa, you can't have a switch of actual job function. What that means is if you're hired as, let's say, a Java developer, right? You can't go from there to being a, let's say, a senior technical program manager and then have that continue. What you essentially need to do is your thing resets at that time. So in a sense, you're tied to a certain job or progressions of a job or job function, and you can't really switch out of that. So there, that it kind of ties your hands a little bit over there. One of the other problems that we generally see is also that when people go into this, because of the large number of applications and because of the slow processing time, because of such a huge number by the government, the progression from H-1B visa holder into a green card holder is, at this point, if you get an H-1B, then for you to get to a point where you have a green card in hand, it is about 12-ish years. And it basically just, you're tied. You can't do anything. You'd be working for a big company, and no matter how much you liked or disliked the job, I mean, you're stuck in the sense that if your end goal is to get a visa to be able to live in this country over a longer period and provide for your family and not have to deal with potentially leaving, you just kind of have to stick with it and wait it out until you get to a certain point. I believe it's until you get the EAD, which is a work authorization or something like that. But yeah, that's kind of how it goes.
So the one reason this is such a hot topic right now is like so many things, Trump has made some bold statements about it, kind of saying that, portraying it as he does, as those foreigners are taking our jobs, which is kind of the way that he likes to talk about things.
I do want to clarify that there's, so this is a, you know, obviously it's a far more complex issue. Now, while I'm not going to claim that our president knows full well the details of such intricacies, you know, he may.
He's not known for knowing the details, but
yes. So let's just say he's not a details guy. But in a sense, it's something that, you know, people need to kind of step back a little bit from the xenophobia aspect of it and think it out. And in a sense, what the way, it's not that people who come in with an H-1B are expressly coming in saying, haha, we are now going to colonize America. It's they're just like everyone else trying to get a job and trying to do their work. And in fact, a lot of times people who have or who are on H-1B visas generally are fairly cautious about what they can say, do, speak up, and things like that, because it'll affect them directly to a point where if you ever want to come back to America and work, if you have an H-1B visa that's actually canceled or something else happens or your employer fires you, then your recourse is to try and find another job as soon as you can for someone else to try and sponsor your visa, which is not cheap, by the way. I believe it's like $8,000-$10,000 or something. They just need to try and find a way to stay in the country and somehow work. A lot of it is also because you have to understand the paradigm of things in India. There's tons and tons of engineers, a lot of people who are coming out of so many colleges out there. And for you to get these kinds of tech jobs, it's not easy. It's just not as prevalent. And so for them, it's, you know, it's just another way to live. And they're coming, they're trying to use a legal channel to come in and work and provide, and they're, you know, taxpayers just like everyone else. But coming back to the paradigm of people taking over jobs, to some extent, they may not be taking over jobs, but definitely one of the things that a cheaper workforce like that I would say their final goal or their end goal is not to, it's to get the green card, right? It's a means to an end. The H-1B visa is to get long-term stability, to be able to stay and earn and, you know, contribute to this country's economy. They are willing to take a hit on salary if need be, because for them, they see that as a far more valuable upside, which is the ability to stay here. What that does do is it definitely does decrease, I'll say that people are able to earn less, or the salary considerations are a little lower, given the fact that there's a lot more competition in the market with cheaper labor. And so it does tend to skew the market. I'm not saying it's a bad thing or anything. This is what it does.
Yeah, the colonization language is a weird kind of language, given that that's not the way that colonization works. And we should know, as South Asians, like, the British came, took our resources, and put us to work. And, I mean, they've done that in a lot of places. So, they put some structure in place. But, I mean, they weren't elevating South Asians to power, certainly. They were doing the opposite. And I think that word has been thrown around in some kind of conservative media.
Oh, has it really? I wasn't aware of that. I was just kind of generally using it because I thought it was funny.
Oh, okay.
Mostly because of why you pointed out. It was like a pun. But
okay. I was assuming that was where you got it from. Maybe they're not using that, but, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I've seen a lot of crazy things.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, I think it's important to take a look at the holistic picture, right? Mm-hmm. And even with what Trump was suggesting we do, or what his policy statement was to increase the salary you could provide for people on an H-1B. That actually does have support, at least for the people I've talked to who are on H-1Bs. They did say that they supported that, mostly because these tech companies, they don't always play nice. I don't want to reserve judgment on everyone and make a huge generalization, because I frankly don't have the numbers and I don't know. But judging by the people I've talked to working at various companies, they are taken advantage of pretty frequently. The H-1B is held over their head. There are people who work here who, there are stories of people who've basically come in. There are companies that operate where you come in, you pay them the money that they need to pay you back to show that they're paying you a salary, and they just show you in a legal way that they're paying you whatever amount of money it is per year, whereas you're actually under the table giving them that cash so that they can show that they're you know, spending money. You know, they're like, hey, I'm paying this person $10,000, and you just turn around and you're paying them $10,000 in cash under the table, and then they're just putting it back in your bank account and showing it in a legal way. And because they're like, well, you know, if you want us to process your H-1B, we can do that for you, but you have to pay for it, and you have to pay for this, and you have to pay for your own salary. There are people who don't get paid for months. They can't do anything about it. The conditions of some of the people who are on, I'm not, again, it's not a large section of the populace, but people, some of the people who are on H-1Bs are definitely taken advantage of, and it is like other H-1B type systems around. One that comes into mind is the kafala system in Qatar. In the Middle East as a whole. I talk about Qatar because I grew up in Qatar. It's a form of modern day indentured labor, and I think it's important to kind of set the for people who are not aware of this issue and aware of what H-1B is and how people are going through it. You need to understand that people live in fear. It's not like everyone on H-1B is just like always super hunky-dory about everything. There are people who find themselves in good situations, good jobs, things they like to do, and things work out for them. But there are also a lot of people who aren't. So it's a nuanced issue. You know, there's a lot to it.
So I want to add some numbers to what you were saying. Currently, there's 1.5 million people who are here on H-1B and waiting for their green cards. Many of them are waiting in that 12-year cycle that you were talking about, waiting for their green cards. There are, on average, people on H-1B actually make around $40,000 less than would be a comparable American worker. That difference is there. But then the flip side of that is that the people who are coming over are skilled labor. So other countries who are trying to build a tech scene are starting to realize that America is not looking so great in the world, and it's not, I guess it's not projecting the same beacon of hope as it used to. So it's not as attractive as a destination for South Asians who are looking to move up. So countries in Europe, countries like Canada, are saying, if you don't want to go to America because of the situation there right now, come here, help us build our tech scene.
I don't know about how much that's narrative and how much that's truth, purely because living in, I recently moved here from Seattle, and even being in Seattle, just being a part of, let's say, two really hot tech markets right now in Seattle and the Silicon Valley in the Bay. There's a large number of people who just the flow in is still pretty staggeringly high. I think initially, after some of the hate crimes that had happened earlier this year with Indians and such, there was some hullabaloo in Indian media about, you know, are people safe and whatnot. And I think you need to just kind of take that as, you know, isolated incidents that are unfortunate, and the people who carried out those crimes are being prosecuted. I think America still offers far more hope. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that this kind of growth, they're talking about skills shortages and the need for workers and stuff like that. But I personally see this as not being the case for a while, to the point where I can see a future in the next 5 to 10 years where a large number of people just get laid off and they just have to leave. And companies will likely go through H-1B holders first is what I would imagine. A, because they're, in a way, they're temp workers in their mind, I would think. They have a renewable visa. And for companies to get them off the books, it's kind of like, I'll say the voting population in America, you don't have a vote, right? Like you're an H-1B, you're on a visa status for how many of your years here, you don't have a vote or you don't really have a say in how things, what happens, right? It's really the companies that have been pressuring, for example, the Trump White House. These tech companies are the ones who are like, hey, no, we still need all that cheap labor right now. So we still need you to, you know, not, you know, push that off. But the moment they don't need that anymore, who's going to speak up for the H-1B guys? Presumably no one, because they don't, you know, they're not really, what's the downside? A bunch of H-1B guys are laid off, they're unhappy, and they come out with all this news, then you're just going to have people who are like, well, you know, if you don't want to be in this country and you don't care, and you know it's unfortunate, and there are a lot of unemployed people in this country, so you could just go back to where you came from.
But that's what I'm saying, is that they may not go back necessarily. Like the Indian tech scene is obviously growing as well, but there's labor shortages, skilled labor shortages in a lot of markets. So even leaving hate crimes to the side, that's part of a larger narrative picture that you look at and say, things are shifting against H-1B workers, and maybe they don't have as much support.
If you look at the number of people coming in to do their master's in the U.S. versus other countries coming from India, their primary destinations have kind of switched a little bit. There's a lot more people willing to go to the U.K., people willing to go to Australia, New Zealand. So there are people who are taking other routes. You're completely right. And that's another trend that we've been seeing, is like people have been channeling out into these other spots where they're trying to build these tech sectors. On the whole, I think the tech market is going to come in for disruption. But I don't know how much this is going to kind of affect things in the longer run. That's what I'm a little unsure of at the moment. I don't have a key reading on things. I think there might be some slowdown. I don't know if there'll be enough of a slowdown or enough people diverting to other markets where the U.S.'s shortage becomes glaringly obvious. And at that point, they're like, you know, yeah, we just need to increase the number of people coming in. Do you have any reason to believe one way or the other that that would change, or what's your kind of take on it?
So my take is that it will shift, because there's obviously a shift towards remote work.
Automation.
So geography is not, it's easier to get a market started that's not replicating Silicon Valley. There's only one Silicon Valley, but there are tech hubs everywhere that need talent. And that if India is exporting talent, that's a good market to be in. And if America is not importing talent, then there are other markets that would want to. One reason that the shift from H-1B to green card is so hard is because we have a really weird green card system where every country has an equal allotment, no matter how big or how small the country. So like Luxembourg and Liechtenstein, you want to come here, it's really easy because there's always green cards available. But you have India and China, you want to come here on a green card, that's not going to be so easy because there's so many people.
Yeah, it gives precedence to certain nationalities over others. A lot of European countries especially have quotas that almost never go fulfilled because the state as a whole and society is not something that they want to trade off for coming to the U.S. And so one of the things I think might help is if they switch that system, and that's been talked about, I think, a fair bit, which is to kind of put it more into a general pool as a whole, and then maybe reduce the number, put it into a general pool, and then maybe tighten the screws around some of the requirements, and especially some of the, I think there needs to be a sword that comes down on like consultant companies that just prey on labor. And that just, you know, they're causing detrimental harm to workers, they're causing detrimental harm to industry, because they're basically being the middlemen pocketing out of this. Find a way to get them out the system. Just flush them out. Because once you flush them out, then you're going to get rid of a lot of inputs. Now, it was easier said than done. Obviously, it's like an ingrained system for many, many years, and there's whole economies. I mean, India's economy is based on that. But, you know, that's something that they could try. The other thing that I've actually talked to some people who work at like Cognizant and Infosys who are telling me that the trend they're also seeing, and this is something that, you know, some of my other friends have also said is likely going to happen, is instead of now trying to get, let's say, a team of five H-1Bs to come and work here in the U.S. or process them, you just get one guy who's like a higher-level manager. So let's say they do the thing that the Trump White House had suggested, which is increase the base-level salary, right? So I don't know the exact numbers, but let's say it's a, you know, you have to pay a minimum of $100,000. So let's say that's the thing they stipulate. And whereas now it widely ranges from like 50 grand to like 150, 200, whatever it is. So let's say they say it's a base salary of $100,000. And what they're just going to do is they're going to get one guy to come here, process his visa, get him the $100,000, get their cut from there, and then have him manage a bigger team overseas of people who are just paid, you know, a fraction of the salary. And then they're just going to, you know, go and keep getting the work done, except the work is now not going to be done locally anymore. It's just going to go overseas. And one of the things that's going to support that is all these cross-collaboration tools and other tools that technology itself that's making it easier to work in different places without actually having to be there. Like you were talking about remote workers or like co-locate, you know, different locations and like going out to different spaces. And so I think that's going to be interesting to watch, to see what happens and how companies adapt. Because already, after Trump's come through, a lot of the big consulting companies from India are trying to readjust their model and trying to kind of head this off at the pass, so to speak. Because at the end of the day, they would rather lose 30% of their income or their so-called cuts coming from these workers or their workforce rather than have, you know, 70 or 60% of their stuff just go away or disappear because of, you know, labor issues. So they're willing to play with whatever the, you know, White House wants or with the business or, you know, the economy wants as a whole.
Isn't what you're talking about similar to offshoring or outsourcing, or what's the distinction?
Yeah, so the difference, I guess, would be with outsourcing a job, you're taking a team. So let's say, you know, we have a team of folks that are working on this podcast. You know, we have no team. It's you and I. but let's say there's like three people that we've employed, right, in the U.S. And then we say, well, guys, sorry, we have to lay the three of you off because we still need this work done. But we're just going to take that work and we're going to send our stuff to this team of three in India and have them do it. Right. So that has to be called out as outsourcing. You're outsourcing the job. Now, if you create a more generalized pool of workers, and I'll give you an example, it's something that I'm in right now, which is called DevOps. And if you haven't heard that term before, it's basically it's a mix of developer and operations. And the idea is back in the day, you needed people to go in and, you know, work on your servers and work on these individual machines. And that was their expertise. You know, they would go and upgrade your operating system and do this stuff. And then you had developers who were writing code and putting their stuff together, the applications, and they were taking it and putting it on those boxes. And these guys would manage that. And something went wrong with the box, they would handle it. Something went wrong with the code, the developers would handle it. So there's this new paradigm that's come out because of stuff like Amazon Web Services, where it's become very easy to actually programmatically create these virtual machines. And so when that happens, now they're just saying, oh, well, now we have DevOps, which is developer operations. So people automating it or people doing stuff, it, you know, they fall into that bucket. It doesn't matter if you're just working on the pipeline part, you're working on this part, that part, you're just the general common pool, you know, and that's fine. Now that becomes a generalized title. Now, if you say, I don't need three application engineers, two release engineers, and a developer, that's like six people, I just need two DevOps engineers, right? So, or you could say I need all six of you are just called DevOps engineers. So tomorrow, if you said, well, I don't need six DevOps engineers anymore, I just need a manager DevOps engineer and a regular DevOps engineer, you're at that point, you're just downsizing your company as a whole, right? You're not necessarily offshoring. But if that that DevOps engineer is represented as this manager, this person who can do all this stuff, and they have all these responsibilities. But really, under the table, what they're doing is they are kind of outsourcing some of that work. That could be a potential loophole that you could be taken advantage of, where you don't necessarily have to call it out in the numbers as I am outsourcing this job. It's more like, you know, we have this person who is working on the stuff that's managing some stuff on their own, and they're giving us back this thing. And they're like, we don't really care how you get this done. We just want this done.
So it's like, it's more micro. It's like, you're essentially an employee is offshoring some of their tasks, and it doesn't really even need to bubble up to the corporate level.
Correct. So as long as you can abstract away some of these things, and which is what I think they're planning on doing, they might be able to play it off. Now, again, it's up to good governance groups and other rights groups and such to flush out some of this information and make this public. But again, with the tech industry, it's really hard. It's flailing. It's large. And, you know, when this stuff happens, there's always ways to mask it out. I mean, how many people have you heard of the situations where people are basically more or less like held hostage, where they're just not, they're running out of cash. They don't have any money. They're not being paid. And they're just like kind of more or less like indentured, and they don't really have any other way out other than just to like up and leave with their families out of the US back to India or wherever, other country in the subcontinent where, you know, whether it's Bangladesh, Pakistan, wherever, where the chances that you're going to find a job doing what you do, getting paid what you get paid in order to be able to support your family, because keep in mind, a lot of these kids come over here, they're not just supporting themselves, they're supporting their families back home. There's a lot of people, you know, it's not a family of two, it's not a family of four. You're talking about 5, 6, 7, 8 people, how many are people depending on this guy's paycheck? You know, it's a big deal. You know, it's a really big deal. And so that opportunity, that ability to do that, it's if that goes away, it's going to be, yeah, it's going to hurt a lot of people. So, yeah. So I mentioned Qatar. So should we hop on to our next topic of discussion?
Let's do it. I'll intro the topic since I'm sure you have a lot more to say about it. So Saudi Arabia has put a blockade on Qatar, which is where Rags is from. Part of that may relate back to Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia, and you can give your opinion on that. Maybe like exacerbate the already existing tensions in that area of the Gulf. So basically what Trump did was he expanded upon arms deals that we already had with Saudi Arabia and really greenlit some deals that were held up. Saudi Arabia is using that to kind of gain muscle in the region as well as bomb Yemen. And that was the reason that they were initially, the arms deal was held up because of humanitarian reasons, because of their bombing in Yemen. And Qatar has ties as well with Israel, with Iran. So there's that kind of Sunni Shia classic tension. And there are a lot of South Asians of all religions in that region. And I'll throw it over to you, Rags, to give a more complete picture of what's going on in the region and how South Asians play into that.
Yeah, so the Qatar thing was really out of left field. If you look it up on the map, it's a tiny little peninsula coming off of Saudi Arabia. I grew up in Qatar. My dad worked in Qatar for 37 years. It was an interesting little country. He'd been working there from the 70s, so he's actually had a lot of. I grew up going to an Indian school, doing the Indian system of education. I only hung out with Indian kids. I never learned to speak Arabic. In fact, growing up, the one thing I remember was a lot of us, we would, you know, a group of Indian kids would get in a fight with a group of Arab kids. And, you know, that's pretty much all the exposure I had living in an Arab country. Which in hindsight, it's crazy to think about that's all I got out of it. But essentially that's what it was. It was kind of a segregated society in that sense. And it was definitely, well, our family being Hindu, we didn't really have any way to practice religion at that time. some countries have relaxed a little bit, but you have to understand that there's a basic difference of ideology there between Hinduism and Islam. Hinduism focuses heavily on idol worship. You know, Islam doesn't necessarily believe in idol worship, to put it lightly. And we'll leave that there because we're not trying to do a religious debate. But the situation as a whole is out of left field because it's a really small country that's kind of doing its own thing. I think somewhere in the 90s or early 2000s, they found on their offshore, basically their seabed that was part of Qatar territory, really, really large deposits of natural gas. I believe at the time when it was reported, it was the fifth largest deposit of natural gas that had been found. For a country that size, it's unbelievable. I mean, when I say it's a small country, it's tiny. Just look it up on a map. And so what they've been doing is when the new sheikh at the time, who took over from his dad when I was growing up, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, when he took over, one of the things he wanted to do was he wanted to start divesting. He knew that there was a, especially after they found the natural gas deposit, he was like, all right, this is our opportunity, right? We need to go away from just focusing on oil because this is not sustainable. It's a resource that there's a limited supply. We need to move on. And so what he did was he started liberalizing a lot of rules with regards to business, so he basically took Dubai as a model, and his idea was let's shape Qatar up to compete with Dubai. You know, we're not going to compete with other places. We're going to try and bring in Western businesses. We're going to ease some of the rules on alcohol consumption, for example, which, by the way, it's like if you're non-Muslim and if you're I don't know if you're necessarily non-Muslim, if you're non-Qatari, like you can go to some of these hotel bars and you can order alcohol and drink, I think. And then there's certain very limited spots where you can buy and consume alcohol in your home. Obviously, you can't go to a bar outside, like, you know, party and like be like, yeah, you know, I'm drunk. Like, nah, you're going to get thrown in jail. But and it's not for public nuisance. It's like if you're drunk and a cop finds you, or if you're drinking, or, you know, smells alcohol, chances are you're going to get thrown in. So you don't want to do that. But he took liberty in shaping the future of the country, went after things like the Soccer World Cup, the Asian Games. And so the idea was to decrease dependence on oil-based revenue and build this new hub for culture. I think Qatar was one of the first countries in the Middle East that opened an Islamic arts Islamic arts museum. And it's supposed to be pretty beautiful. I myself haven't been back to the country since my dad retired back in 07. And so it's been a while. But I do keep hearing back from some of my friends who are still there, who went to high school and who actually ended up working in Qatar. And right now, it actually seems like most things are fine from a personal perspective for the people who are living there. And the authorities actually are focusing pretty strongly on finding ways to decrease impact of the blockade as a whole. Yes, there are tons and tons of South Asians there. And so we're exposed to a lot of different cultures, but by and large, a good chunk of the populace was kind of segregated to their own people because, you know, there were just so many of, you know, your own kind. And so you just associated with them. But we always had like kind of, you know, mixed South Asian type events where Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladesh, everyone get together and we'd all, you know, do stuff. So it was cool. So the impact on them at this point is not super high. So Qatar as a country seems to be okay for the moment, at least publicly, that's what they're saying, right? What I think is happening is, yes, I think Trump going there, the timing just makes it seem like he was like, you know, possibly Saudi and those guys were like, hey, you know, we need to do something about this Qatar country because they have Al Jazeera and they keep talking smack about us and about our policies. And, oh, you know, they've said some bad stuff about the U.S. too. And I could totally see a conversation where El Presidente was like, wait, what? They're talking smack about all of us? That's awful. You guys should just do whatever you got to do. And they're like, really? We can do whatever? Yeah, do it. We got your back. And they were like, sweet. And they were just like, we're just going to block you guys completely. And, you know, as you can tell just by Tillerson, came out later and was like, hey, guys, come on. You know, let's just let's just sit down and chat about this a little bit. You know, we don't need to do this. Come on. Because, and there were some reports about potentially Trump not knowing that Qatar had one of the largest U.S. military bases in the region. I think something like 10 or 11,000 troops. We have a lot of troops in that country. I saw American soldiers quite a bit growing up. And this happened after the Gulf War. I think after Saddam and all that, we basically, Qatar was like, I think the Sheikh at that time was like, yeah, U.S., yeah, we're cool with you. We have no beef with you at all. Y'all need to open a base and come over here. Do it. It's cool. And so, because Qatar doesn't really have an army either, right? Like, they're kind of a small country. So they were like, but, you know, as long as you guys will help us out, you know, if people come after us too. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, sure, don't worry about it. And so I think that's kind of how, you know, obviously I'm colloquially summarizing things. But I think what's happened is, from all reports, Al Jazeera seems to have really irked a lot of people in their region. Qatar is also supporting the Muslim Brotherhood before Sisi came into power. And so I don't think Egypt was very happy with that at all. Qatar was a huge proponent of Mohamed Morsi, because after they had a democratic election and the Muslim Brotherhood, basically, they were a set organization that were able to turn into this political machine and be able to go out, campaign, and win votes. And a large majority of the population actually voted for them. And so Qatar was like, hey, look, democracy is winning. Yeah, the Muslim Brotherhood came in, except a lot of people in the Middle East don't like the Muslim Brotherhood. I believe it's because they're more conservative and a little bit more religious. By the name of Muslim Brotherhood, you could probably tell. Saudi, again, wasn't happy because Qatar, I think, was trying to help the Houthis out a little bit in Yemen. Saudi's just been bombing the crap out of them. Yemen, a country which is on the brink of famine at this point, millions are going to perish. The international community doesn't. They're just kind of out of the purview of the world at this point. U.S. Saudi's just signed a huge arms deal, which they're basically going to, I would assume, go and just bomb the crap out of Yemen even more than they have been. And by the way, there's no surgical strikes there. That's just like let's just bomb large swaths of land. And I think Qatar's kind of tried to move more to a center position and try to become a little bit more of a deal broker. And, you know, they had this deal with the Taliban. Like, the Taliban had like this office in Qatar, and they were the ones Qatar was mediating with Taliban and other, you know, the US and with Afghanistan and things like that. And I think some of these other countries are like, oh, hold up, you know, you're a tiny ass country, it's over here, and you want to do all this stuff, and you're trying to like show us up. You need to stay in your lane a little bit, you know. So I think they're trying to like force their hand. The problem is Qatar is just coming out and they're like, what, guys, what are you, you know, come on, can we talk about this? Like, why are you guys being so mean, you know? And so since they're not like attacking back, and also the source of all this was purportedly a fake news article, right? Did you hear about the thing like where?
Yeah, I saw that. That's crazy.
So right now the U.S. intelligence is saying that Russia basically planted this article that said that the Sheikh, current Sheikh of Qatar, went and basically was talking smack about Saudi. And so Saudi was like, what? You're talking shit? Like, oh, we keep it real. You know, it's like the Chappelle skit. You know, when keeping it real, you know, goes wrong. So they're just trying to, like, you know, push the dialogue that way. But, you know, crazy enough, there's some weird stuff happening. All of a sudden, for this country, which has been it's a predominantly Sunni country that has always played. Saudi is pretty much their only land border. They get most of their stuff to Saudi. They've been on good terms with all the countries over there. They find themselves in a position where Iran is like, oh, you guys need help? Psh, we'll help you guys out. And so apparently they just flew over something like 60 planes worth of food, planes packed with food, fresh supplies. Turkey is kind of like on the side of Qatar. So they're like, hey, yeah, you know, if you guys need some stuff, let us know. And Turkey's down. Iran is like opening up their airspace because all these other countries basically block their airspace out. And then you also, just recently I read an article about how this local businessman in Qatar, they were trying to divest from Saudi supplies of milk. A majority of the milk and dairy produce comes from Saudi Arabia over land. And they're like, no, we wanted to set up dairy industry in Qatar to help our local population so we don't have to rely on exports. So just now, this dude basically flew over from around the world, from UK and from some other spots, a bunch of cows and created this massive farm. This is a plan that they had to do, and they were going to actually ship over, I think, over by boat and start setting stuff up by September. But because of the blockade, they just took like this $8 million hit, this businessman who's, you know, probably pretty well loaded. And he was like, okay, I'll just fly the cows over now. And we'll just have to start production soon. And so there, that industry, that's going to come in and take over, apparently supply at least a third of the demand off the bat starting the summer. And so there are ways that they're putting contingency plan. They're not moving. They're not really budging, right? Like they're like, look, we're willing to talk, but you guys can't be like, no, we're just not going to, you guys are bad. Like, we're just not going to play nice with you anymore. And we're going to block our airspace. And they're like, dude, you can't just do that. Like, we have other ways to go about it. And we have a ton of money. Like, what are you going to do to us? And so, again, a lot of these reports that have been coming out from Qatar and from some of these places, you always want to take it with a grain of salt because, again, state-controlled media, so...
But it is state-controlled media, but it's interesting that Al Jazeera is so big there, too. I'm wondering what the media diet of the people there are, and I think the South Asians in the region are mostly lower-skilled workers, if I'm understanding correctly. So
I think it's possible that a majority might be, but I don't think it's like 80-20. I think it might be more like 60-40, if that, right? Like, because you need a lot of the people who are building the stadiums for the World Cup, which, by the way, we can go into, I can spend an hour talking about the visa situation in Qatar. How there's indentured labor there, and how awful things are in the Middle East for people going as day laborers and such. But we'll reserve that for another time.
That'll be another podcast.
Likely. Irrespective, South Asians by and large tend to mind their own business, do their own thing, read media that's more relevant in their own countries. It's different in the U.S., right? Like the U.S., when you come to the U.S., there's a culture that's different, but that's something that allows acceptance and that allows you to kind of integrate.